Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for being here this evening. I once heard a Zen teacher say that when we tell Zen stories, we start to make them ours. So I am grateful to you for giving me that opportunity. And the stories I would like to share today are related to some of the things that I've been thinking lately. And those things are the idea of time and space, and also causing no harm, and what it means to be of a tribe. I'd like to paste in the chat a small poem that was written by the wife of a samurai in medieval Japan. Some of the words are difficult to pronounce, and because I have a foreign accent, maybe you will not understand me, so I will paste it here. And this is a poem that is quoted in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. So the poem, the brief poem says, "As you unreel the thread from a spool, I want the past to become present." And it was written by Sato Gosen, who was the wife of Minamoto no Yoshitsune. He was a military commander of the Minamoto clan in medieval Japan. And the only reason I became interested in him is because, you know, I've always been intrigued by this idea of time being able to move from present to past, not in our logical mind, but in the actual way we experience it. I remember last year I was reading Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, the audiobook, and I was at the local beach, and I just listened to that and to the poem, and I said, it really stay with me. You know, it's one of those non-logical things that feels like poetry. So I've been thinking about it. And because of a recent experience that I have, that I will share later, I revisited this passage of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. And since this, the name of this military commander is mentioned, I just did a little bit of a search to see who he was. And he had a very interesting story, and also it's interesting for me to know what he represents for the Japanese imagination. So Minamoto no Yoshitsune was a military commander of the Minamoto clan in medieval Japan. The legend says that he was sent to a Buddhist monastery at an early age, but he eventually left the monastery to become one of the most famous samurai fighters in Japanese history. In his book, The Nobility of Failure, Ivan Mori says that if Yoshitsune hadn't existed, the Japanese might have been obliged to invent him. Much of his life was, in fact, embellished over the centuries to create one of Japan's quintessential heroes. It is said that after a series of brilliant military victories, Yoshitsune spent his last years as a fugitive till he was finally killed at the age of 30. He is the perfect example of heroic failure. he fell at the very height of his glory, betrayed by those whom he had trusted. He was not practical, and he was politically innocent. And those were weaknesses that led to his failure, to his downfall. But from the Japanese point of view, they count among his most admirable qualities, being associated with the sincerity, which in Japanese is makoto, that denotes the true hero. His person and career, especially as developed in the legend, embody almost every characteristic that appeals to the Japanese national sensibility. In battle, he was imaginative. In private life, he was spontaneous, trusting, and sincere. But above all, he was loved for his misfortune and defeat. If Western literature is full of heroes who share the common element of victory, many of them dying to achieve their goals, Japan is full of heroes who lost their lives without achieving their goals, and in many cases fought their battles knowing they would end in defeat and death. I've always personally also felt attracted to this kind of heroes, so it was interesting to read this story. And so Dogen Senji said that time goes from present to past. And Suzuki Roshi reminds us in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, that saying that time goes from present to past is absurd. But in Zen practice, sometimes it is true. And then he quotes this poem by Yoshitsune's wife that illustrates how time can go from present to past. The poem was written by Yoshitsune's wife, as I said, soon after he left for the northern provinces of Japan, where he was killed. And the poem that I posted in the chat says, "Just as you unreel the thread from a spool, I want the past to become present." In her mind, Suzuki says, the past became alive and was present. And it really stayed with me when I read it. So I am quoting now from Beginner's Mind. So as Dogen said, time goes from present to past. This is not true in our logical mind, but it is in the actual experience of making past time present. There we have poetry, and there we have human life. When we experience this kind of truth, it means we have found the true meaning of time. Time constantly goes from past to present and from present to future. So, on a recent Saturday afternoon, after a meeting at Kanondo where we addressed the issue of causing no harm, and also after listening to one of Les's recent talks that I edited for the podcast, where he said that that is a non-negotiable part of our practice, the intention to live without causing harm, I felt very nostalgic about my father, who never said anything hurtful to me. And the longer I live, the more I think how extraordinary that was. So he is one of my personal heroes. So I got into the car and drove to the house where he was born. It's an almost 200-year-old house that is nearby, a stone house. It's now abandoned, but it's still there and in pretty good shape. And I also drove by the river where we scatter his ashes. There is a small pond where he played with his siblings when he was a child and where he learned how to swim. And I came back home really feeling that somehow my father and I had met in that Saturday afternoon, and that this experience of time going from present to past, it was kind of true to me, just not in a logical sense, but in the way I experienced it. It happened, this kind of feeling. I also had it once when I was living in Mountain View. I used to go biking around the shoreline. I was living in Palo Alto at the time. And, you know, many of you are from the area, so you know there are these very long trails. Once I stopped at the middle of a trail and I thought, where would this trail lead? And I never kept going because I had biked long enough. So a year after that, I moved to a house in Mountain View that was very close to the beginning of the trail. So I entered through the other access. And I came to the point where I was a year before wondering where the trail led. So I felt that I was meeting my old self that was wondering where the trail led. And that was also an interesting experience. And the other story that I would like to share today is about Liu Tiemo. She's one of the female Chinese ancestors. And her story is part of the book, Women of the Way. So Liu Tiemo was the daughter of a poor peasant who lived in 8th century China near Mount Hua, a sacred flower mountain. When she was old enough, she left, and on her journey, as the story is told in the book, she stopped at convents for shelter. She liked the Buddha statues she found there, thinking they could sit on anything with the same stillness. They could sit with poverty, they could sit with pain and with injustice. At one of those convents, eventually she asked to be ordained. She didn't talk much at first, but after a few years, she began to roar. Once she started wandering, she met many monks in debate. When she met her teacher, Gishan Lingyu, she was as sharp and pure as a diamond drill. And I kind of became interested in Gishan Lingyu because he had an exchange with a student that I share here on another talk, and that really inspired me. And it's one of those stories that has been transmitted to us that gave me strength. And so the exchange, Gishan Lingyu liked to call himself a water buffalo. And in this exchange with the student asked him, where will the teacher be in 100 years' time? And he said, I will be a water buffalo at the end of that mountain. So that image of the water buffalo was so powerful to me. And the way it's being interpreted is a poetic image of the bodhisattva vow, meaning that the water buffaloes do all the hard work, like, you know, going through the rice fields and through the mud. And it was a promise he was making not to abandon any beings. So it is said that Gishan Lingyu was an undecorated person who is said to have taught with his body in the small moments of daily life, using circles drawn in the air. And he also taught through the winter wind. He lived in an area of long and hard winters, but people said that no one was cold in his presence. I really like that. In time, 1,500 students came to live with him, but he transmitted only 43. And Liu Tiemo was one of them. It is said that when Liu Tiemo met his teacher, she was already fearless. And after being transmitted as a teacher, she left to live alone. In the year 840, when Liu Tiemo was old, Buddhism became under attack in China, and she hid in the mountains. Gishan liked to say that a person of the way is unconcerned. He was unconcerned, and so was Liu Tiemo. And then I like to read a few paragraphs at the end of from Women of the Way, at the end of the story about Liu Tiemo. So these last two paragraphs go like this. When she was getting old and Gishan was frail, she went to see him again. And he called her old cow. Old cow. Well, she was a female version of the water buffalo. So, old cow, I see you have come. You have come, said Gishan, who liked to call himself a water buffalo. She leaned on her staff in his doorway, implacable as a rock. And she said to her teacher, she told him, tomorrow there is a great feast on Mount Tai. Will you go? Mount Tai was 600 miles away. What was keeping him? To one who understands the nature of time and space, there are no real obstacles in time and space. Bodies are one thing, relationship is another. Can your mind go where it needs to go? She asked. Can you freely move within all the restrictions of your old human body? They were like two mirrors facing each other. Who sees, who is seen? Seeing each other like this, they experience the recognition everyone craves, to be seen exactly as we are, nothing more and nothing less. Seeing like this, all the many forms in the world are the same as one's own hand, one's own face. At her words, Gishan lay down, sprawling on the floor. The iron grinder, that's how she was known, Liu Tiemo, turned and left without another word. No need to talk about it anymore. When she was gone, Gishan smiled. He might as well die with a disciple like this. So, as I said, I've been thinking, what does it mean to be of a tribe? In the context of our practice. And, you know, I've reflected, I'm sure you all have a story about how you came to practice. So I came to practice in 2002. I was living in DC and I went to San Francisco to visit a friend and I wanted to do a retreat. So a friend of mine in DC who had read Suzuki's book, told me, oh, there is this place called Green Gulch, who was started by a Japanese monk. And if you would go there, it will be a retreat, but it will also feel like a vacation. So I went there and I had a sense of warmth and also freedom. I like there was a table for silent people. And I like that. Nobody was questioning or... I felt a sense of acceptance. And I felt this was a practice that could allow me to fully express myself. So that's what's for me part of being a tribe. But part of being a tribe also for me is this encounter with the past, with our ancestors and with the stories that were transmitted warm hand to warm hand over centuries. See if I can share a poem. Yeah, so just to end, I would like to read this poem. It's called We Are of a Tribe by Alberto Rios. It says, we plant seeds in the ground and dreams in the sky, hoping that someday the roots of one will meet the upstretched limbs of the other. It has not happened yet. We share the sky, all of us, the whole world. Together, we are a tribe of eyes that look upward, even as we stand on uncertain ground. The earth beneath us moves quiet and wild, its boundaries shifting, its muscles wavering. The dream of sky is indifferent to all this, impervious to borders, fences, reservations. The sky is our common home, the place we all live. There we are in the world together. The dream of sky requires no passport. Blue will not be fence. Blue will not be a crime. Look up, stay a while, let your breathing slow. Know that you always have a home here. Thank you.
I was thinking about the Navajo tribe in America, where their language does not depict future. They only speak in present tense. They don't speak in the past tense or the future tense. And your talk reminded me of the use of language to erase future and past.
Mm. Thank you for sharing that. I didn't know that. Dave?
Thank you for your talk, Teresa. I'm kind of wrestling with this whole idea of the flow of time between past, present, and future. I think it's fair to say that our normal sort of, I don't know if it's a Western conception or more general than that, our idea, I think, is that each moment exists in the future and draws closer and closer, and then for a fleeting instant becomes the present and then recedes deeper and deeper into the past. So the flow is from future to present to past. And yet in the poem, it seems to be the other way around, that the past becomes the present, which is sort of the exact reverse. So I'm kind of wrestling with that, and it reminds me of that wonderful quote from Suzuki Roshi where he says, actually, each moment contains its own past and future. Well, I wonder if you've been able to sort of come to terms with this whole idea of these two seemingly contradictory notions of the flow of time. I'm sort of struggling with that.
Can you repeat the quote, please? The quote that you just mentioned?
Suzuki Roshi says in one of his talks, he says, each moment contains its own past and future.
Yeah, I wonder what he meant by that. It wasn't difficult for me to understand the idea of the past becoming present through this poem that he shared by bringing that memory, she brought the present alive. But I wonder, when a moment contains the future, I guess, I don't know what that means. Maybe it means that whatever is happening now will have a continuation, or will somehow lead to something in the future.
I don't know, but it's always, I've suspected that perhaps what he was saying is that our experience is only in the present. We only experience things in the present moment. And in each moment, the past and the future are abstractions that really exist only in our minds in the present moment. I'm not sure that that's what he meant, but that was sort of the way that the best I could do to understand what he was saying. I don't know quite how to relate that to this idea of the past, the present, past and future flowing in either direction.
Yeah. And I wonder, you know, I wonder, what are your thoughts on what I read of Liu Tiemo? I will read it again. I really would like to, because I don't have an answer, but I'm very intrigued. So I will read that paragraph again. So Liu Tiemo, she was old, and she goes to see her teacher, who is also old and frail. And she tells him, tomorrow there is a great feast on Mount Tai. Will you go? Mount Tai was 600 miles away. What was keeping him? To one who understands the nature of time and space, there are no real obstacles in time and space. Bodies are one thing, relationship is another. Can your mind go where it needs to go? She asked. Can you freely move within all the restrictions of your old human body? What do you think about that? To one who understands the nature of time and space, there are no real obstacles in time and space. I was hoping some of you will have an answer to this. Can your mind go where it needs to go? Anyway, I don't know, I was intrigued. I thought maybe it's a difficult one. Oh, Candy.
I think, and I don't remember where I first heard about this, that time is man-made. It's not something we're born with. We learn it from our parents, the concept of time. Children have a very children have no concept of past and future. They just are in the moment. So what becomes the purpose of time? And what if we had one day without time? If we didn't think about time, if we were just in the moment, it's kind of like our meditation. Our meditation, we're just in the moment. There's no past or future. We're just there. Ever since I heard about the concept that time was man, that the concept of time, past and present, was man-made, I've thought a lot about that. How would you live without the concept of past and future? But the animals do. The Navajo do. It's an interesting concept in conjunction with our Western way of thought, in which we have to have past and future. It's an interesting conundrum.
And it's interesting that you mentioned that that animals live without that notion of time. Because I recently, a few months ago, I adopted a cat, a street cat that came to my door asking for food. And then she became pregnant, and she 2 weeks ago she had 4 kittens. And I thought, you know, she knows what to do. She does, she knows what to do, she knew the day she was gonna have the kittens. She knew where to go. She knew what to do after they were born. So I thought, if she knows what to do, we also have to know what to do. We have that. We have that. I guess it's a question of being connected to our intuition. But many times we think we don't know what to do. At least I do. Philip? Yeah.
I just continuing on what Candy was saying, but also what your talk touched on, which was so beautiful. Thank you. I really, that was like being, it was like a poem. Itself, the talk. That when Suzuki, I've always been a little jarred by that story about Yoshitsune, is it? When Suzuki says, that the true nature of, he talks about the true nature of time. And it's always, I've never quite grasped, or just intuitively anyhow, I didn't quite meet with what he was saying, but in your talk and then what folks are saying, it seems that what he's saying about the, anyhow, that's what I'm thinking is what he is saying is that the true nature of time is beyond our concept of linear time. It's something much more profound, and it's not a concept like that a word can grasp, and that is the that is the beauty of poetry and this story of that you told about the nun and her teacher. That there's something deeper, more powerful going on that we sometimes can touch into or feel into. And I felt like your talk tonight was touching that in different ways.
Thank you, Philip. You're always so generous with your comments and encourage all of us. Thank you.
Well, thanks for your talk. Not so much a question, but it's all this talk about time makes me think of a lot of things I've heard about time. And people like Einstein said it was an illusion, although a persistent illusion. And in our interactions with time in the scientific world, you know, what's past, what's present, what's the future, it's all relative. It doesn't exist in any absolute sense. And so, I mean, it seems to me that, from my experience anyway, is that time is an artifact of a limited perspective. And we as human beings we live in a world of very limited perspective. As our perspective expands and expands, what's past and what's present and what's future gets wider and wider and wider until it's just an artifact, and it's a way of talking about our experience. We have a label called time. We have a label called past. We have a label called present. We have a label called future. But those are just a way of talking about our limited perspective. You know? Mm-hmm. I don't know if that makes any sense to anyone, but there's a lot of things like that. You know, we have a lot of questions about things that are really just an artifact of, for example, a belief in the self. That can create, what's going to happen to this self? What does this self's existence mean? Those questions are artifacts of that assumption. Without that assumption, no need for even the questions. If you look into a little tiny hole in a fence and a cat walks by, first you see his head, then you see his tail. But if you open, and so one comes after the other, but if your perspective widens, the head and the tail are there at the same time, so-called time. You see what I'm saying? I mean, that's how I, because I've sort of wrestled like you with this issue of time. It's pretty mysterious stuff. but I got a feeling it's just an artifact of our limited perspectives as human beings, which we are. Anyway, that's all. But thanks for your beautiful talk.
Thank you, Van. Thank you for your contribution. So I was asking, unless somebody has any other contribution, I was asking you about if you have anything you would like to share about what it means for you to be of a tribe. Or if you feel you are of a tribe or not, maybe. Meaning Sangha and the relationship with our ancestors. Dave?
Yeah, I've been sort of pondering since you first raised that question, Teresa, because I've been doing some reading recently about theories of the evolution of both aggression and cooperation and how those relate within versus between tribes. And I mean, if you look at that from, a purely evidentiary point of view, some of it is pretty disturbing. There is a documentary I saw about tribal interactions in Papua New Guinea that is quite disturbing, if indeed you take it as being in any way reflective of evolved human nature with respect to tribalism. But the vision that was in that long poem that you read seems to be much more both pleasant and satisfying, and also more consistent with our attitudes in Zen practice, that, you know, there's this sort of common thought that what binds a tribe together is not only the positive feelings within the tribe, but the external pressures from competing tribes. And the idea that really the tribes all belong together under the blue sky seems like a much more pleasant way of looking at things. I am fascinated by some of this reading I've been doing about the possible evolution of some of these tribal behaviors, but at the same time, I find it rather disturbing. Hmm. Maybe disquieting is a better word.
Thank you, Dave. I always like that, what you mentioned about sitting together in the sendo with others is like quieting our mental chattering together.
Yes, yes, very analogous. Very much the same thing.
Dan, thank you.
On the issue of tribe, I think for me, it struck me that what was happening when they were reflecting each other as mirrors, that was the epitome of Sangha and tribe in a pleasant and sort of socially and personally uplifting sense. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was really beautiful. I had never heard of Iron Lu before. Grace Dahman spoke of her a year or so ago, and she was a larger than life character to me in that conversation. It was really good. And every time we read the matriarch's names, I see Liu Tiemo, and I think Iron Lu now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's good to know their stories.
Yeah, that's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. It's good to find mirrors. I go swimming every day, and the swimming pool where I go is kind of very quiet. Not many people. Many of the people who go is kind of older. This week, one of the days I went, there was a swimming club of young athletes. And they were swimming so beautifully and so fast. And then I was also in my lane giving my best effort. And I said, oh, yes, it's so good to get inspired, you know, and be with others who just... And it made me think about the difference between practicing alone and practicing with Sangha. What you were saying, Philip, a couple of weeks ago about how you were inspired by when you sat near Carolina and how she was sitting like a rock, and that helped you to kind of also go through your discomfort. Oh, you're muted, sorry.
I was thinking about what you said about tribe and the sense of connection with people who have gone before. And there's a lecture that Shunryu Suzuki, where he talks about the feeling of, that Dogen wrote this just for me, or Ichiren, do you know what I mean? And it seems arrogant or kind of arrogant, but that connection, and when it's really sincere, it seems like he was talking about that feeling of tribe beyond time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that feeling when you read something or when you hear a talk and you feel, oh, this, yeah, this was written for me. So nice. I don't think it's arrogant. It's a nice feeling. I told somebody the other day, oh, you know, somebody gave a lecture and it's just what I needed to hear. Mm. And she told me, isn't that what we all need to hear? I said, maybe. I don't know, but I love that feeling. And then I guess that's, you know, when you connect with somebody, when the words of somebody resonate with you in the context of Buddhist teaching or any teaching.
You think it's maybe another incident where the linear concept of time or the scientific concept or whatever is transcended, or something, some other kind of time or something happens where, like that teacher going 600 miles to that celebration, that the logical, it feels like there's a real connection, I guess, so, like what you're saying when, you know, when you read something or hear something, mm-hmm. but it's not restricted by even by centuries.
Yes, it's true. And some of the stories or images that were transmitted to us can give us a lot of, or at least can give me a lot of strength and inspiration. Like Thich Nhat Hanh says in his book, The Heart of the Buddha's Teaching, I think is the title of the book, right? The Heart of the Buddha's Teaching. And he just, it's a basic reminder about breathing, the focusing on breathing as our anchor. And I was reading that and it's just basic, but he said, this has been transmitted to us over 2,000 years. That has a lot of weight. Had a lot of weight for me, you know. It's really, look, pay attention. This has been transmitted to you for two thousand years. Sorry, more than two centuries. That's like, wow. Yes, I have to pay attention to this. All these people who came behind, one after another, after another, after another, and even if it seems so simple, just pay attention to this. But I really like what Gandhi said about animals not being aware of time and also having a lot of confidence that tomorrow they will eat, or, you know, or not even confidence, just they don't worry. I guess some of you were at the annual meeting on Saturday, no? Must have been great to see each other in person. I don't know how it was for you, Philip, talking about weird things, but it was the most, it was a very strange feeling, because I think the technical team did a great job with, you know, showing the Canon Do, the space and all of that. But then when I disconnected from Zoom, it was like a hard landing on my dining room. It was like, so weird. And I was talking to a friend of mine and she said, yes, technology does that. Because when you say goodbye to somebody in person, there's like a transition. You just say goodbye and then you just go to your house or to wherever you have to go. So your brain has some time to process it. But, you know, she's been working a lot with technology for a long time. And she says, with technology, it's so abrupt that I don't think our brains are wired to kind of deal with that. It felt so disconcerting for me. I've never had an experience like the one I had during the annual meeting on Saturday, because I was very immersed. It made me, I think that's why I thought about this passage of, you know, your mind being able to go places, because I really felt somehow I was in California. And then I just like, oops, no, I'm not in California. Weird.
I felt I had pushed the leave button when Les came over to say hello to us. And I felt sad. I tried to get back on, but he was leaving, and it felt kind of magic. It was kind of like a dream. It was kind of magical. Yeah. And then it was gone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, Candy, you're muted.
The memory is still there. That connection is still there. And the 600 miles that you talked about, it's still there. Even though you can't see or hear people, you're still, the heart is still there. Mm-hmm. It's the parting of, it's like almost like a ceremony of parting, hitting the leave button, or do you, or you don't you, or what's everybody else doing? It's that, the saying, I don't want to say goodbye, but I'm going to hit leave, you know.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that you're meeting in person again.
It was so beautiful. Diane is still here, I think. But the having the both screens, it was really, really a nice experience.
It was incredible. Yeah, very nice. Well, thank you. Thank you, Les, and thank you, everybody else, for joining the talk today. As I said, I thank you for giving me the opportunity to tell the stories so they become a little bit mine. Thank you.
This talk was brought to you by the Canandoe Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.